Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Coffee Clatch. The Coffee Clatch and Special Needs Talk Radio Network feature outstanding programming for the special needs community. Our team of hosts provide educational interviews. Our shows are not designed to provide listeners with specific or personal medical, legal, or professional service or advice. Parents of children with health issues should always consult their health care provider for medical advice, medications, or treatment. Any show discussing rights and law for special needs children in special education are presented as general information and not legal advice. Special Needs Coffee Clatch Limited does not promote any host or guest individual practice, programs, treatments, or products. We thank you for joining us and are proud to provide excellence in broadcasting for the special needs community. And now, on to the interview.
Good evening. Welcome to the Bright Not Broken radio show on the Coffee Clatch Network. We are so pleased this evening to have as our very special guest Dr. Jonathan Way. He is going to be speaking with us tonight about visual spatial abilities, twice exceptional, and the educational system, issues that are near and dear to both Rebecca and myself, as well as many of our listeners, parents and professionals alike. Before we get started tonight, I just want to read a little bit about what we're going to be talking about tonight. Dr. Way is an expert on the development of intellectual and creative talent. He is a researcher and a writer at the Duke Talent Identification Program, and one of the highlights of his work has been to explore the importance of spatial ability for the STEM programs, that's science, technology, engineering, and math. In those areas, many of our spatially talented students are neglected by the typical school system, and that is something that we all share frustration in. We're going to speak tonight about the college entrance exams, the SAT, the ACT, and how they focus primarily on the core math and verbal abilities that also lack a spatial measure. So we've got these brilliant kids, and we're all missing how to help them out. Dr. Way, welcome tonight to our program. Let's just get right to it. We're just so excited to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me here.
We've got so much to talk about tonight, so I hope we get to it in our 30 minutes. And, of course, Rebecca, I would like to welcome you tonight as well. I know you're with us.
Thanks.
First of all, before we get started into the meat and the nitty-gritty of this, Jonathan, let's talk about, if you could, just give us an explanation for our listeners that may not know these terms. What are visual spatial abilities, and what is spatial intelligence?
Well, you know, when you talk about spatial intelligence or spatial ability, generally, it's a construct, a general construct. But there are, of course, many different components to it. But to talk about it generally, it's basically the ability to visualize or rotate figures in the mind in three dimensions. Often visual spatial learners are also really good with working with their hands. Some examples of people who would be in professions that are high visual spatial would be mechanical engineers, some scientists that do visualizations, as well as mechanics, for example.
Okay. That's certainly the areas that we have had some personal experiences with as well. And Rebecca, would you like to comment on that?
Certainly, because as a classroom teacher, I know that looking at a student and seeing whether they can rotate images in their mind or how they perceive and process information differently, if you will, than the typical learner in a classroom, those aren't things that we're trained to bring out or to see as teachers. And in your article, why don't we value spatial intelligence, you talk about how the education system is centered around reading and mathematics and writing, and how the emphasis is so much on numbers and words rather than on mechanical genius. Yet even as we shift in our culture from manufacturing to technology, I guess one of my questions is, do we still need people who can process that way? Or because I think of machine tool and die, I think of those kinds of areas. And so as a layperson and as a teacher, can you educate me a little bit about just in terms of other areas that we are preparing our kids for, what some of the strengths and challenges and what some of the fields might be and why we don't value it so much?
Well, wow, that's a really complicated and good question.
It's very complicated.
Yeah, well, I don't know about the new fields that are coming about now, but certainly, you know, with big data here, I mean, mathematical mm-hmm. skills are more important than ever. We're drowning in data in the world. People with math skills, people with programming ability, which is related to spatial intelligence as well. A lot of programmers visualize what they do before
okay.
they write their code, for example. And certainly engineers are still very important. And, you know, I think, you know, more and more, I think our culture is moving towards a lot of visual things. And, you know, every invention, you know, the iPhone we have in our hands, that was invented by someone's idea in their mind's eye, you know. And, you know, we just need to, we just need to remember to value that. I think that the school system is highly verbal in nature. It's secondarily mm-hmm. mathematical. I think that we actually kind of find it socially acceptable to be bad at math, which is kind of strange, but it's true in America. But, you know, at the same time, I feel that spatial thinkers, in a way, who are not as mathematical or verbal, they kind of just get lost in the school system because, you know, teachers, they teach with words, they write words on the board, students read words in books, and then they're expected to respond with words. And so it's all this, a whole bunch of words, actually, and then a little bit of math in there, but not a lot of visual spatial stuff.
May I ask you another question then? Because as a teacher, I try to present information as visually as possible as well, and also to engage as much as possible the full body in the experience. But
yes.
I know a lot of my colleagues, we've all moved to YouTube videos, just anything that we can use to visualize and to connect with students. Do those technologies help the visual spatial learner, or is there more that we need to do?
Well, I think that they do help. So I was going to mention that I think even video game interventions can be useful today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, educational technology
mm-hmm.
is extremely important and helpful. But I think that, you know, we could probably include more hands-on activities. For example, you can teach chemistry through hands-on things
mm-hmm.
As opposed to other methods. And so if you can include more hands-on activities for spatial learners, which it sounds like you do, which is great, I think that will help these kinds of kids.
I actually have them build a research paper structure out of Legos using color coding so that they can at least somehow see the structure of a paper before they have to, you know, before they have to commit to actually writing it. Because some of these kids, like you said, they are very verbally challenged. They don't express themselves well. They tend not to engage in conversation as readily or easily, but at the same time, they are very keen, and they're very misunderstood, I think.
And what you said there is really interesting. I do think, even when I write, for example, I like to visualize structure of an essay, for example. There's a principle of symmetry. And I think that a lot of these students, they actually can learn to write, you know, over time, because writing is really a craft. You just have to work at it.
Mm-hmm.
And no one really is born a good writer, you know. So I think that a lot of spatial kids can learn to write by visualizing first, certainly. So.
Diane?
That's an excellent analogy. And, you know, as we've talked about many times before, writing is one of my area of struggles and one of your gifts, Rebecca. So it's interesting how this comes about, and of course, I guess I would fit the mold as well, that I struggled in that area, but I also was a very high math and science student, so I guess I have a little bit of everything in there. but, you know, when we talk about these students who are so strong in their visual spatial abilities, they often do not have the science or the mathematical abilities that come with that. And as we mentioned earlier, and I know there's still several parents I speak to, and I'll just use the word STEM, and they have to stop me. So I'll mention it again, that STEM stands for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And there is a current push to try and get these fields bolstered in the education arena, and also a need for STEM innovators. As we continue to use our standardized test, though, it doesn't include a way to measure this spatial ability or help us recognize these talented students, which, again, fall through the cracks, as we've talked about many times. Can you tell us, Jonathan, a little bit about your current research in this area and what your hope for the future of STEM is?
Well, some of my work with my colleagues David Lubinsky and Camilla Bendo of Vanderbilt University, we basically showed that across 50 years of research, cumulative research base, we showed that spatial ability has predictive power above and beyond math and verbal ability in the prediction of STEM outcomes. So basically STEM outcomes like being in a STEM career, for example, or earning a PhD or something like that, or earning a patent, for example. And basically, what we showed is that spatial ability has predictive power, which means that we really should be measuring it in schools. We really should be developing that kind of talent. And if we're not testing for it, then in a sense, we're kind of undervaluing it, right? And it also means that these talented students are being missed because, well, if you just use the math and verbal tests, it's easy because every test has them, right? I think we've all taken standardized tests where we always either have a math, let's see, an English section, science section, a writing section, reading comprehension, but really no visual spatial section. I mean, there may be some people listening who have taken a couple of those, but it's probably rare. So in that sense, I think the ACT and the SAT are college entrance exams. For example, they don't include spatial measures. And, I mean, this is unfortunate because it actually means that and it turns out that in Project Helen, which is a stratified random sample of 400,000 students across the United States, basically we used this random sample and showed that a large fraction of the most spatially talented students were in fact not as mathematically and verbally talented. And so it shows that in the population there are a large number of these students, and that we're not identifying them. And it means we're not developing their talent, which is unfortunate for the future of America, especially if we're going to push for STEM.
Right. And I would, as I mentioned, although I was strong in science and mathematics, and I am a very visual spatial learner, my son struggled. Mathematics was his greatest weakness, although, as we've discussed and we've written about, he is extremely highly intelligent in a visual, spatial, mechanical way. And I homeschooled him for a short time. And, of course, I went right to the tough subject and tried to find out where his lapses were. What I discovered wasn't really a disability in math as much as a comprehension, as much as he wasn't understanding, and it makes perfect sense that he had to visualize it. And sometimes numbers and letters, especially together. His comment was, "Who came up with the system where we mix the numbers and letters?" He thought, he said, "Let's just start
with that." They can
look
kind of similar too, right? So.
Right, right. And of course, that's the basis of algebra. And we're not going to get, you know, to where we need to be in physics or elsewhere unless we can understand the most basic things of math. And so, as I was correct that his disability wasn't a true math learning disability, he caught up with almost 2 years of algebra that he was behind in just a few short months. But visualizing had a lot to do with that. We did a lot of visual tactics and props and things where he could actually work with the numbers, not just see them. And I couldn't agree more that we've got to find a way to measure that ability to keep us from keeping these kids out of the STEM arena.
And the thing is, we do have reliable and valid measures. We just don't implement them. And I think it just hasn't caught on. Maybe our culture just hasn't found it valuable yet, you know?
So. Right. Well,
may I jump in and ask a question here? Because you were talking about the large percentage that you discovered and that are actually spatial, visual spatial learners. I wonder if you all have done anything that, and I apologize, I would have done more background research on this, but have you done anything in terms of linking spatial ability to creativity?
You know, honestly, I think that that's something that's going to, I mean, it's obvious that spatial is related to creativity. I mean, I think today we talk about the word creativity. It's this buzzword. It's very popular currently. And right now I think people think of creativity in terms of creative writing, you know, dance, things like
mm-hmm.
that. But in a purely creative sense of science or like engineering or patents or developing an iPhone or building a new device, you know, I mean, that's great creativity, you know. That's great innovation.
Mm-hmm.
I think spatially talented learners, people who are high in spatial, are some of our most creative people. And there, I think, you know, people just don't realize that as much. You know, you see a car that's nicely designed, you know, but you don't really think about what goes into that. You just think, oh, I like it. It looks good. I can drive it. You know, it takes me from A to B. But, you know, imagine the amazing, you know, visualization that went into actually mm-hmm. designing that. It's amazing, I think.
Well, and in terms of the measures of creativity that you were talking about, are there any really good tests for that type of creativity rather than the, you know, the storyboard and you can develop a line or you can paint a picture, but are there any really good tests out there that test for that kind of creativity at a young age where we might be able to capture these learners early on? So that we can foster these gifts, because to me, this is the economic future of America, as well as the problem solving, as well as, you know, this is our future we're talking about. The survival of humanity actually may lie in these wonderful minds that are so untapped.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if there are specific creativity measures.
Mm-hmm.
To my knowledge, and to be honest, I come at this from more intelligence perspective, but
okay.
I think there's, you know, some of my work has also shown that, you know, intelligence is highly related to creativity. I mean, if you don't know things, you can't create beyond them. So to me, I feel that certainly, you know, if you're high spatial, then you are more creative in a sense because you have the ability to create. And that doesn't mean that everyone who's really good at spatial ability will also be creative? No, not necessarily, but it's kind of a threshold condition where you kind of need to be quite able in certain abilities before you're able to do creative things, I think.
Okay, yeah.
And if I can jump in here for a second, because I really did love your article about, and I love the Iron Man picture that went with that, Tony Stark's, and he's a great example of that. And if I can point out, because I think, and we've really talked about the standardized test and how they don't include our spatial intelligence measures, but, and I know that Rebecca can speak to this as well as a teacher, we talk about it in some different areas, that teachers tend to teach to what they gravitate towards. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that's a problem?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, it's not just teachers. I think it's all of us. You know, we relate to people that are like us. That's why, you know, we tend to see other people who are like us and we say, oh, you know, I understand that person.